I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Michael McGarrity. He is the author of many books. The last one, the latest one, is called Hard Country, a novel of the Old West, and he will be speaking tomorrow evening at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening in conversation with Valerie Plame Wilson. Welcome back, Michael.
It's always good to see you, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to see you. Now, this book is called Hard Country, and Hard Country is right. It is one rough land that you're talking about. It's the area that we're living in, the plains east of here, and then Santa Fe, Tularosa, this whole, what was 150 years ago, New Mexico territory. And how did you decide to set the novel there? Some of the characters are the ancestors of people whom we know from your other books.
Right. Well, that was the whole point, was I wanted to do a prequel. And I'd been thinking about it and researching it for years. When I finished my 12th novel in the crime series with my protagonist, Kevin Kearney, I approached my publisher and I said, I'd really like to do a prequel. And I knew it was kind of a stretch because what I had proposed was a 100 years of history and four generations of one family, stretching from the mid to late 1800s to the end of the Vietnam War. And I did a two-page proposal at his request and turned it in, and they bought it. They bought the concept. So I was ready to write this prequel, and I got about a third of the way into it, Mary Charlotte, and realized it couldn't be one book. Just couldn't possibly be one book. Well, by then, my editor and my agent had already looked at some chapters. They were loving what I did. And so I went back to them with a proposal to turn this prequel into a historical trilogy. And they bought it. So what started out as one novel covering four generations of a single family and 100 years of great Southwestern history is now a planned trilogy, with Hard Country being the first book in the trilogy.
And it's 600 pages long, which I think by far the longest work of fiction you've written.
It is. It's a bigger book in terms of its scope, in terms of its reach as a writer, in terms of its breadth, as far as the story goes. And it was a real challenge. You know, this book is just crammed with New Mexico history and New Mexico characters.
No
real
kidding.
Characters, yeah. From our past. And I'm just tickled pink that it came out during our centennial year, because it really is a book that's a slice of New Mexico history, a very rich slice, because it covers some of the most contentious and adventurous and dangerous era time of our past. So I'm just really totally pleased with it from that standpoint, in terms of couldn't have been better timing to have this book out now.
When you write, let's say, a murder mystery or a crime novel set pretty much in the present, there's a lot of things that you can take for granted because you know the time that you're living in. You see it, you breathe it,
exactly.
You smell it. When you do something like this, there are so many possibilities for getting it wrong.
Absolutely.
From the language to the names of the characters to infinite numbers of historical detail.
A lot of fact-checking had to go into this book, both during and after it was written, to make sure that it's as accurate as possible. Not only does language change, but the landscape has changed in 150 years since this book opens. I mean, the land no longer looks the way it did when the Texas cattlemen first broke into the Tularosa Basin to find grazing land for their cattle.
Lush, green plains.
Belly high to a horse.
Yeah.
Right? The other thing, besides accuracy, is I have tried completely and deliberately to avoid every cliche of the old Western novels.
Uh-huh.
And that is something that I would like people to tell me whether or not they feel I've succeeded at or not. I think I have. We've all seen the Western movies, we've all read the Louis L'Amours, we've all know the stock sort of iconic characters that show up in that particular genre. And I wanted to avoid that 150%.
Give me example. Give us examples of some of those clichés.
Okay, one cliché is the ignorant Hispanic or Mexican peasant of the earth.
Ah, okay.
Right? Who, you know, barely can speak the language, who is poor and struggling, and really kind of racially stereotyped. I think you'll find the characters that I've created in this book that are Hispanic are thoughtful people who are educated well within the context of their time and place. And
more so than some of their Anglo-American counterparts.
Right. And then the whole issue of this is an era when the Indian Wars were going on, and so the Native Americans painted as savages. And I think you'll find that there's one character in this book that's Native American, that's an Apache, who is a very engaging, clever, insightful man who has a lot to add in terms of helping the other characters in the book understand his perspective and who he is and where he comes from. So there's that. And then there's rich history. There's one of the great unsolved murder mysteries of the Southwest in this book that still to this day, to this very day, is contentious in the state and still totally unsolved because the people that were convicted of it were acquitted. I mean, weren't convicted. They were tried and acquitted. The murder of Albert Jennings Fountain and his 8-year-old son on a lonely, dusty wagon road between Tularosa and the village of Las Cruces. All of those things are woven into the story, I think, in a way that makes it totally engaging. There is an absolutely delightful, feisty, independent, strong woman in this
yes,
book.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, it was she needed to be in this story.
Who's a real person and not just some kind of two-dimensional feisty
right.
lady.
Right. Real. And up against some real troubling situations that are compelling and at times maybe difficult for the reader, but still very real, very, I think, thought-provoking.
We're talking to Michael McGarrity about his new book, Hard Country, A Novel of the Old West. It is interesting. I mean, it starts from the perspective of John Kearney's wife, John Kearney being the main character in the first section of the book, and she is a young woman, immigrant from Ireland, living out on these windy plains and comes to hate it. And there is something that I've seen in a lot of literature about the frontier is the women basically don't want to go west, and when they do, they're often miserable, and the men love it. And John Kearney loves it, and she wonders how she got there, and there's nothing she can do about it. And that sense of either the excitement of self-sufficiency or just the utter desolation of that same situation you paint beautifully.
It's point-counterpoint, really, when you think about it. And it's still, in many ways, a harsh environment that we live in. We just live in... we don't live in it the way we used to. We don't live as part of it as we once did, as our forebears once did. But that whole environment, I mean, it took... I can remember going into a bookstore here in town where I buy reference material and getting a couple of books on West Texas. And the bookstore owner said, "You don't write about Texas. You don't write about Texas. Why do you need those books?" And I didn't tell him why at the time. I just said I'm interested in it. But I had to find out. I mean, we've all driven through the West Texas plains,
right.
Okay? But I had to find out what it
as
really
quickly as possible
at what it looked like.
Yeah.
What it really looked like back then when there wasn't I-25 cutting a trail from Albuquerque to Amarillo. And so creating that realistic environment that I could place her in that was so desolate, that was so depressing for her, it had to be real. It had to be something authentic that the reader can visualize and see.
Do you have sources in the sense of diaries by women of the plains that you used in your research?
I have documents like that. And actually, on my website, and in my author's note in the book, I mention it. I put up a select bibliography for this book that consists of, I think, about 90 primary references that I used. And a lot of them were those kind of private diaries or family-published memoirs and histories that really enrich your understanding of the times, because it's a much more personal history.
Now, let's talk about the character of John Kearney. He's the ancestor of, what is he going to be, great-great-grandfather or something?
Great-great-grandfather, yeah.
Yeah, of Kevin Kearney, whom we know from your other novels. And he seems at least somewhat similar to
great-grandfather,
me.
Great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather, yeah. Okay. In the sense that he is an even-tempered, good guy, never gets sick, never gets mad, tough, yet gentle, and almost too good to be true, except at the very beginning he shoots a dog.
Giving away the story, are you, Mary Charlotte?
Sorry.
What's your point?
Dog deserved it. No, but it's I mean, did you write him with his great-grandson in mind?
I think there are some traits that carry over from generation to generation, and part of those traits have to do with personality as well as physical attributes. So there is a type that that he represents that I think translates to his great-grandson. But then look ahead to Kearney's grandfather, who's a completely different type and a much more difficult character and much less of an even-headed, moral, steady kind of guy. So, you know, things skip generations, too.
Right.
One of my favorite characters in this whole story, though, is a fellow who's not even a member of the family, but is really the glue that holds the family together for some time, and that's Cal Duran, who really becomes a surrogate parent to a couple of the primary characters in the book.
Reading it and being in the place, being in New Mexico now and reading this place where we recognize in some ways the landscape, in some ways we see a different landscape, but we're in the same place. It's so striking how in such a relatively short time, I mean, not that 140 years is that short, but so much has changed, and all the some of the things that they long for, we have to access, and some of the things that they long for, that we long for, they have to access. So they've to access. They've got wide open spaces. Mm-hmm. They've got huge amounts of cheap land. They've got fertile land, no pollution, fresh water, and
fewer,
all this.
Fewer people.
Las Cruces is what, 2,000 people?
Yeah.
At that time.
Right.
And on the other hand, so, and again, we don't want to talk too much about the plot, but John Kearney's son basically ends up with a relative who dies, and then he's trying to find this son, and that takes a while. And when you think about how hard it is to find people and how incredibly difficult communication was at that point, and how not only easy it is to find somebody now, but how hard it is if you don't want to be found.
That's right. Well, this book has an element of searching to it, and it's searching not only for family, but it's searching for place, it's searching for identity, it's searching for a better life, and there is something very basically American about that that is part and parcel of our mythology, which is what makes the Western novel really a book. A well-written Western novel, I should say, a book of mythical proportions, because it's part of our legacy. It's kind of like our equivalent of a Greek tragedy in a way. And one of the things that actually gave me shivers last week is there's a journal that reviews books called Kirkus, and their review of Hard Country compared it to said it was a worthy companion to Lonesome Dove and Sea of Grass.
Nice.
And that's what I was looking to try to do.
Yeah.
I really didn't start out to write a Western. I started out to write a family saga, and the fact that it's a Western is probably less important to me than that. It's more historical than it is, anything else, but it's Western in terms of setting, and how can you let that go, because it does play such a big role in it.
The language that you use is, I think, very carefully researched as well as crafted, and I don't think that you're using cliches by any means, but there is this, like the use of the word mosey, and there's a number of other words that we associate with Western movies, but they are authentic to that time.
Absolutely. And you notice there is a dearth of y'alls in this book.
Mm.
As a matter of fact, my copy editor, when they were proofing the novel, said, you only used y'all three times. And I said, yeah, isn't that great? You know, because I wanted to avoid overusing those kind of phrases and words that have seemed to become, again, so cliché.
Let's talk about the Apache characters. We're introduced early on to basically two young people, a teenager and a child, who are brought to John Kearney's ranch. And the way they behave, they are so quiet and so wary and so different from us. Mm-hmm. And the little boy is observing them and can't understand them. How did you create and understand their behavior?
I've had some opportunities to be with Native people and to begin to learn a little bit of the cultural differences that impact how they interact and how they talk and how they respond to others. And the Mescaleros are particularly shy when it comes to outsiders. They're more turned inward, if you will. And there is a very strong tradition for Native people to never interrupt. No matter how long it takes for someone to tell a story, they will sit and they will listen and they will not interject unless they're asked to. And so there is a tendency and a cultural ability to remain quiet, to remain thoughtful and respectful, and to remain very watchful for any kind of cultural cues, that they need to be aware of. That is part and parcel of a different way of using language and expressing oneself than we are comfortable with. So I had to create the Native characters, especially the Mescaleros, because those are the Indian characters in this book, as realistically as I could. And from my past novels, as you know, I've had a Mescalero Apache police officer in some of the later books that is Kearney's illegitimate son. And so I had to continue that legacy of having a different way of viewing the world and dealing with the world and interacting with the world with these characters in Hard Country. It was a lot of fun to make it as real as I possibly could.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book, and it is highly readable. It draws you in and really doesn't let you go. I mean, if somebody wants a good, a way to escape from whatever they're going through in their lives right now, pick up this book and you will be in it for a nice chunk of time. And I was thinking, I mean, another thing, speaking of policemen, the whole question of law enforcement, and justice or lack of justice at that time is really front and center.
That was another thing I had to research because, okay, I have modern experience, as you know, as a law enforcement officer, but what was law enforcement like? What was policing like 140 years ago? Well, it was completely different. And the law was much more remote, much less accessible, much less of a presence in people's lives, especially if you were living out on the land. But even in small communities, there weren't that many town marshals, there weren't that many sheriffs or deputies. Most municipalities didn't even have any kind of police force to speak of. So the law was further away and less important. And what trumped the law more often than not was friendship loyalty, and trustworthiness. Those three characteristics were more important to the people than whether or not a lawbreaker was brought to justice. In a much larger scale than we see today. I mean, as a police officer, I might just give somebody a warning at a traffic stop rather than writing a ticket, or I might take the initiative to place a child in the protective care of a relative or a good friend rather than putting them in child protective services for a while, or cutting someone some slack on a juvenile misdemeanor. Those kinds of things were doubled, tripled, and quadrupled 140 years ago in terms of what kind of latitude a police officer might have, or the attitudes that the citizens had about crime in general.
Well, and there were things that weren't really considered crimes, like somebody did something, somebody stole your cousin's cattle and killed your cousin, you shoot them. And that's how it goes, and you're not going to go to jail for that.
Yeah, the whole idea of protecting property was seen much differently than it is today. But there's an interesting... I'll give you an example from the book. I think I can't remember who it was who says it in the story, but I have a rancher say something like he's eaten beef at his table every night for years, and not one of them has been one of his cows, right? So it was common practice to cut a stray out of a herd during a roundup, or to pick up a stray that had wandered onto your property and slaughter that cow for your larder, even though you knew it was a neighbor's cow.
Because it had their brand on it.
Yeah, it had the brand on it. But, you know, it was still a maverick. It was still running loose. It was on your property. Was it a crime? Yes, it was a crime. But it was a crime that people turned the other way and didn't even bother to try to enforce or uphold.
Right. And you also have the reality that you have this Hispanic subculture, this Anglo-American culture and Indian, I mean, the so-called over-romanticized tricultural thing, but you've got not only three different cultures, but three entirely different ways of life when it comes to, I mean, the very idea of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do. And I think that shows itself in the book. Anyway, I'm delighted that you like this book. I wanted you to like it when I made sure that you got an advanced reader's copy.
Thank you.
And
it's really good.
We had talked about this some years ago, right? And you had shown interest in it as a project of mine. And
well, it's so interesting. I mean, again, I think a book like this would be interesting. I'd gladly give it to my relatives in Germany because they like Western novels. But it's I think, deeper for those of us who are Westerners and who live here and who want to understand. Like, for example, I was thinking about the American myth of self-sufficiency. Mm-hmm. While reading this and where it comes from.
Right.
And the love of technology, because in a time like what you portray in the book, any little bit of technology that makes your life a little bit easier is so welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're in a period of seeing technology sometimes in a critical way, in ways in which we've gone overboard and are ruining our own earth, which we are.
We are, yes. True.
But one can see where the enthusiasm came from.
Sure.
And that whole self-sufficiency thing, on the one hand, you've got John Kearney who builds a whole lot with his two hands. On the other hand, you see how interdependent everybody in a territory like New Mexico was at that time.
I think one of the interesting things that shows how culture can advance so rapidly is the establishment almost out of nowhere of the town of Alamogordo on the eastern side of the Tularosa Basin, right? What starts as a water stop for a planned railroad that's going to run up the east side of the Tularosa from El Paso north, all of a sudden, in a very short period of time, actually becomes a town, a viable town. And it happens almost, when you think about it, it happens almost in an instant. It happens so quickly. And there you see how the railroad, this wonderful thing that people on the East Coast took for granted for almost 100 years, for let's say 80 years or 60 years or 70 years, finds its way into the territory of New Mexico and suddenly changes people's life. That's technology happening right there.
Right, and you have people bemoaning the railroad because it's going to change the Santa Fe Trail.
Right, and you have a character in the book saying, well, what's the sense of having another town on the east side of the Tularosa Basin, right? We don't need it.
We're talking to Michael McGarrity about his new novel, Hard Country, a novel of the Old West. So while there are murders and revenge of various kinds and things like that, it is also a departure from your books in the sense that it's not just a I don't want to say just, but it's not a crime novel or a mystery in the sense that you've written before. So it really is, it must have been such a challenge for you.
It was a challenge. It was not an easy challenge, and it's not going to be an easy challenge for the next two books either. But that's the whole point, Mary Charlotte. If you can call it in, if you can phone it in, is that really the creative process? Is that really what a writer should do? I don't think it is. I think the reach should always be a broader reach. You should try to do more with your craft, do more with your talent, and that's what I wanted to do with Hard Country. And I like to think I succeeded. I really do like to think that.
I would like to put a check in that column.
Thank you. One of the things I want to mention, though, is homage is paid to a character in this novel that's whole cloth real, just like some of the others. But the character that I want to mention that I had just so much fun building into this book is Eugene Manlove Rhodes, who in the early 20th century was the most popular writer of westerns in the entire country. And he grew up on the Tularosa, he cowboyed on the Tularosa, he began his writing career on the Tularosa, and he is largely, totally forgotten. But he is not forgotten by me, and it was so much fun to bring him to life and make him a supporting character in this book. And I just hope that those people who are big fans of Eugene Manlove Rhodes will enjoy seeing what I did for him in Hard Country.
Are his books available?
Yeah, you can still get his books. University of Nebraska Bison Press has, I think, still in print an anthology that has a number of his novels available. And then used bookstores can find. I found one at Stevens recently that I picked up for $6 or something. So yeah, the old books are around, and there are reprints of them available.
So this book ends at World War I, and you've got you've got basically most of the 20th century left for your next. Well, no, what do you end at? Yeah. You end at the end of the
Vietnam War. Yeah, right. So book two, which I'm calling Backlands, will basically cover the years of the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression, and World War II.
Are you going to stay in New Mexico?
Oh yeah, I mean we're still on the ranch. I mean, if you remember the story, the backstory of Kevin Kearney, he's born on the Tularosa, right? He's is forced to leave when the government expands White Sands Missile Range. All right, so the family is on the Tularosa until the early 60s. Okay, so yeah, that's home ground for the trilogy.
And do you have a sense of where it's going, or do you discover that as it goes along?
Well, I have both. Both happen, you know. I have critical ideas that I'm writing down and little scenes and snippets that I'm putting together that will help with the transition. And I know how it starts, which is always important. There's that great line from the Hours movie with where Virginia Woolf, I think it's Virginia Woolf, says to her husband, "I believe I have the beginnings of a first sentence." And that is always, always, always the case with me, is to have that beginnings of the first start of the book.
I'm guessing you also have one or two more strong and interesting female characters up your sleeve.
Absolutely, yeah, and some good supporting characters too, yeah.
Any more real people? Well, I guess we'll find out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got to find a way to get Bill Mauldin in this book. Bill Mauldin was the Pulitzer Prize. He won two Pulitzer Prize. He was the most famous cartoonist of World War II, created the Willie and Joe cartoons, and then won another Pulitzer Prize later on in his career. He was born in a little mountain village in the Sacramentos, which is on the east side of the Tularosa Basin. The Sacramento Mountains are on the east side of the Tularosa Basin. And became a cartoonist and a reporter for the Stars and Stripes in World War II and served in Europe. Well, how can and lived here for years, came back to New Mexico, lived here for years. And he's a Santa Fe, a native son of New Mexico. And I know one of his sons. So I've kind of promised Andy that I'm going to get Bill Mauldin in this story. Maybe just for a cameo, but I will get him in. And there'll be others.
The book is Hard Country, a novel of the West, of the Old West, by Michael McGarrity, who will be tomorrow night, Friday, at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening with Valerie Plame Wilson doing the Q&A with you.
Well, she's going to interrogate me. Yeah, I mean, being the outed CIA...
Being the trained interrogator.
Trained, outed CIA operative that she is, but she has promised me no waterboarding.
Is she an interrogator? Do all CIA agents get trained in interrogation?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. You have to be trained in that. That's basic. That's part of the basic training. And I'm just delighted to have her doing this and being willing to do it. And it's kind of a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. I think more people are going to show up to see Valerie than they are to see me.
I'm not so sure about that. It's a wonderful book, and you've got a loyal and sizable following. Michael McGarrity, thank you so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Mary Charlotte. See you next time.
See you next time. I'd like now to welcome to the program Blake Wood and Vlad Henzel. They are ultra-marathon runners. They are two of the organizers of the Hemez Mountain Trail Runs, which are happening on May 19th, Saturday, coming up. And I'd like to welcome you both to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
So ultra-marathon, I mean, marathon's bad enough, but ultra, that means running even more than 26-point-whatever miles.
Well, of course, a marathon isn't bad, and an ultra-marathon's even better.
I'm just saying this from my perspective of just thinking. I mean, I walked once from Santa Fe to Chimayo, which is about the length of a marathon, and thought I was going to completely expire at the end of it. But running, I mean, this is a kind of, it's not just an athletic endeavor, it's a mental endeavor that you're engaged in if you do that level of long distance running.
For most of the people, yes, they definitely. And it also is that these really hard ultra marathons, people don't just run it, many of them walk parts of it, significant parts of it. Only really the very best runners are able to run from the start to the finish.
So how long are the ultra marathons? I gather there's more than one kind of ultra marathon.
In general, it's any race that's longer than a marathon. Typically, 50K is a common distance, 50 miles is a common distance, 100 miles is a common distance. There are staged races that are longer, and you go day after day for either a certain amount of time or a certain distance. Our particular, the longest one that we have here is a 50-miler. We'd love to be able to put on a 100-miler up in the Jemez. Hopefully, we'll be able to do that someday.
What does it take to train for these kinds of races?
The training is not a lot different than what you might do for a marathon, with the exception that you need to get used to being out on your feet for a long time, for many hours at a time. So typically, you know, the kind of training I do is similar to what I would do for a marathon, but on the weekend, I'll typically go out on the trails for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. And just get my body used to being on its feet for that long.
Now, I have to ask you, do you see people using those funny kind of little barefoot runner shoes with the toes in them and stuff? Are people starting to run long distances in those?
Yes, it started recently that even on these very long runs and even very technical trails, which are very rocky, that you can see people using these vibrant five fingers.
Yeah.
And some of those people are actually pretty fast, and I find it very amazing. It's not for me, but some people start using it more and more.
Now, here at this altitude, training probably gives you a great edge if you're doing a marathon closer to sea level.
It gives you a little bit of an advantage. Along with that, it has the disadvantage, of course, that you can't run as hard up here. We see that in particular in shorter races as well. You know, I coach high school and track at the high school, and cross country and track at the high school, and we find that when we take the kids to sea level, they have the altitude advantage, but find that the race is much faster than they're used to. So it's harder to train fast up here.
Ah, that's interesting. So they, in theory, could run faster, but they're just not used to it.
Right. It cuts both ways. Now, for ultramarathons, many of the ultramarathons, because there are many of them, are at least in this country, are typically on trails and often in very beautiful places up in the mountains, having the altitude advantage when you're running a race, you know, like the Jemez race that goes up to 10,500 feet, or races up in Colorado that may go up much higher than that, being able to train here at 7,000 feet in Los Alamos or Santa Fe is an advantage for that.
You can basically see it almost every year that you have people coming from Kentucky or Tennessee or Georgia, and they normally at the in the east, they are very good and pretty fast ultra runners, but when they come here, they usually join the mid-pack because they suffer from the altitude.
What's it like to actually have the experience of running, say, a 50-mile race? I mean, it's a very long period of time that you are out there, running, also walking, but running and walking.
Well, for me, it's it differs probably for everybody, but for me, it's an enormous feeling of accomplishment. I'm not sure if I really enjoy myself during the run itself because so many things hard. Your legs are trashed, you know, your stomach is in ruins, you cannot drink, you cannot eat. But at the end, the closer you are to the finish, you really start feeling absolutely incredible. And I sort of live from this experience for the next couple of months. And you just look then on the map and you just can't believe how much you have covered, that you have seen whole mountains or the huge mountain range in just in one day. So it's something very, very special. And not to mention like the social aspect, that if you are running with somebody on a pretty even pace for hours, there's some sort of bond between the people.
It's not like you're talking though.
Sometimes, yeah. Some people love to talk a lot. I do here and there. Usually I'm out of air, so I'm not really a good partner in talking. But some people love to talk about family, about work. Some people talk about Texas. It's just, you know, sort of steer your attention from the pain. And so you can hear a lot of amazing stories, and then you just come to the finish. And
now, do you enjoy, I mean, you're doing this outdoors in the Jemez Mountains, whatever, do you enjoy the landscape, or are you just in too much pain to even think about it?
Well, you know, it's not all about pain. In fact, the being outdoors and seeing some of these beautiful places is one of the attractions. We get to run through some absolutely gorgeous places. And in fact, this race, the 50-mile version of the Jemez runs, in fact, has a very long loop, about 20 miles worth, in the Valle Caldera
The park area.
Yeah, the park area up there, that is not ordinarily open to people. And getting to run through that section is going to be a big attraction for this race.
Yeah, definitely. We're talking to Blake Wood and Vlad Henzel about ultramarathon running. Now, I mean, not only do you have to deal with running a really long distance and all the physical things that you were describing, you know, your stomach and your legs and everything, but you also have to deal with terrain and God, Lord knows what kinds of impediments, not to mention weather. What kind of things have you, the two of you, encountered on your various courses?
Well, I have less experience than Blake with this respect, but when I started running ultra, I started pretty much in the most insane terrain you can imagine. My first race was in a little town called Hell in Michigan, which goes through swamps.
Called Hell?
Yes, it's called Hell. It's a little town near Ann Arbor. So it does exist. It has like 270 people.
It's a good place to start an ultra marathon.
And a lot of it goes through swamps, so you run through mud, which is at times chest deep. You run through river or through lakes. Here in the mountains, you sometimes have to use your hands to climb up some rocks. So the terrain can vary a lot. Of course, you have some parts where the trail is very, very smooth. It's a beautiful single track through meadows, and you just can enjoy the view around. Some other parts, you just really have to pay very, very close attention to the rocks, so you just don't trip.
And so the time in which you finish, let's say you finish in a certain number of hours, is meaningless unless you know what the track and the terrain are. You can't compare one 50-mile ultramarathon to another.
Absolutely.
Very much.
Yeah.
On the road, you can run 50 miles probably under 6 hours, or I can run in 8 hours. I can run in 8 hours. But here in Hamas, my time is 13 hours, and the winners go below 10.
Wow. Now, what are some of the weather conditions that you've encountered running ultramarathons?
Well, since I tend to like the ones that are up in the mountains, of course, there have been many of them where I had to go through torrential rain or snow or thunderstorms. One of the interesting aspects of running ultras like that is that planning the logistics for the race is actually an important factor. There are plenty of people that have had to bail out on a race that otherwise was going very well for them because they didn't have enough clothes. Or forgot to take along something they needed, or you know, I've had races spoiled because my flashlight burned out if I'm running at night.
Oh my goodness!
So, along with the challenge of simply being in condition, you also have to do a fair amount of planning to make sure you have what you're going to need, to anticipate what you're going to need, and that you're prepared for conditions if they get bad.
Now, do you actually carry all that stuff in a backpack? Are you running with stuff on your body?
It depends on the race. Here at Jemez, I will probably just use a couple hand bottles, and if it turns out to be cold, I might carry a windbreaker and tie it around my waist or something. In other races that are particularly 100 milers or 50 milers that say go into the night or something like that, then I would ordinarily probably carry a backpack, some kind of, like a camel bag or something like that, that has some water and has some space to put things I might need. I ordinarily carry one of those when I train on the weekends when I go for my long runs.
Right. Now, how long has each one of you been running? Have you been doing this your whole lives since, what, teenagehood or?
I ran for the first time, started running when I was 16, but it didn't last long because I suffered some running-related injuries and had a long, long break. And basically,
well, you were a smoker for a while.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't go well with running. And actually, running helped me to quit because it just was hurting too much.
Yeah.
But I think that consistently running long distances on a marathon level or longer, it's probably been about 4 or 5 years. My first really long ultra of 50 miles was 2 years ago.
And so what about you, Blake? You've also been doing it for decades.
Yeah, I started running when I was in high school almost 40 years ago and have been running ever since, never stopped, have been running races ever since. And I started running ultras about 20 years ago.
How does it affect the rest of your life, if it does?
I think it has a positive effect. So far, physically, my body seems to be holding up okay.
Which is not to be taken for granted.
No.
I mean, you put a lot of stress on.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, I'm probably getting close to having run 100,000 miles in my life. And so far, so good. Part of that is being smart about training and not doing things that are going to hurt me. Part of it is just, honestly, good genetics. I chose my parents well, so to speak. And
well, you have that kind of slim, lithe frame that's good for cross country, certainly.
although actually you'd be surprised. In a lot of these races, you get all body types. I'm constantly amazed at the wide variety of people that come out and do ultras. Yeah. It's not all just skinny people.
Right.
I think that actually there were some statistics from Western States 100-mile race that the average body mass index of the finishers is close to 25. It's like 24.5, so that definitely is not only skin and bones people.
Right.
Many of them are pretty muscular. Some of them are little ample even. Because it's not just about, especially these long ultras, they are not about physical abilities only. They really, a lot depends about the state of your mind and how much are you willing to put in the race.
Now, how has it, Vlad, affected the rest of your life, if it has?
Well, I just recently am struggling to keep my training consistent because of obviously with family, with two little kids, with my wife working as well. It's not very easy to keep a regular time for running. So I sort of try to run whenever I can, which sometimes is almost zero for a week. Sometimes I get 10 days in a row when I can get out. But especially since I've been running ultras, I've been running injury-free, actually. I think that even those trails which look brutal because of the you know, the roots and mud and rocks, I think that they still are much nicer to my body than the road. So I totally quit running on the road, and I've never suffered any issues except like really tripping and yeah, I had bones broken, but it's like traumatic injuries, but not these things.
Repetitive motion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It helps to have an understanding family.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
My wife really enjoys the ultras and comes and helps out at all of them. Is involved with the organization of several of them. When my children were small, they're all out of college now, but when they were small, they came to the races. Two of my daughters have run with me in races. One of my daughters has run a couple hundred milers with me. It's nice to have it integrated into your family. And it takes some effort to try and make sure that all the hours you're spending training isn't impacting your family life. I try and be careful about that.
Now, the ultramarathon community is really worldwide. There's people on every continent, with the possible exception of Antarctica, that are doing this.
Well, I think that actually there are some ultras at Antarctica as well.
Chasing penguins?
Probably. But I think that it's growing in popularity. Of course, like road running is way, way, way more popular than ultra running. But I think that almost every year there's 10-15% more races all across US or Europe, and more races are being sold out every year.
So people have probably already signed up. I mean, anybody who's going to run a marathon or a half marathon or anything to do with the Hemis Mountain Trail runs on May 19th, which is a Saturday, they've already signed up. But if people are interested in finding out more about this, is there a website or is there a way people can connect with you guys?
There is. The Hemis Mountain Trail runs, if you simply Google that, you'll find it. The website page is off of the highaltitudeathletics.org High Altitude Athletics Club site that we have in Los Alamos in Santa Fe. If you simply search for JMTR or Hemis Mountain Trail Runs, you'll find it, and there's information in there about the race, course maps, entry procedures, and results once the race is finished.
And the two of you are both doing the 50K run?
No, 50 miles.
The 50-mile run.
Oh, it's the 50-mile run. You're doing a 50-mile run in Hemis Mountains on May 19th.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, mazel tov. Have a wonderful run. Blake Wood and Vlad Henzel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.